Hello and welcome to the Third Sector podcast. I'm Emily Burt.
And I'm Lucinda Rouse. Each week we bring you half an hour of discussion and debate about the important goings-on in the charity world. This week we'll be joined by Divya O'Connor, recently appointed Chief Executive of the Cherie Blair Foundation for Women and host of the Charity CEO podcast. We'll be hearing her thoughts on podcasting and its applicability to the charity sector, as well as some exciting research that they've been doing into artificial intelligence. But first, our senior news reporter Emily Hall is with us to tell us about a recent interview she's done with something of a veteran sector leader. Emily, who have you been talking to?
Hi, so I headed to Breast Cancer Now's office to speak with its chief executive, Baroness Delith Morgan of Trefellin.
What a title. Why did you interview her now?
So she's retiring from her role at Breast Cancer Now at the end of June. And as we're recording this, we've just heard that Claire Rowney, who is currently the Executive Director of Fundraising, Marketing, Strategy and Innovation at Macmillan, will be replacing her as the charity's chief in September. Delith Morgan's retirement marks the end of a really interesting career. Breast cancer has always been a major focus for her. She was chief executive of breast cancer charities for a total of 23 years. And her first leadership role was the chief executive of Breakthrough Breast Cancer before she took a break to become a working Labour peer. She returned to lead breast cancer campaign in 2011. The charity itself has gone through some really big changes, not least two significant mergers, which saw Breakthrough Breast Cancer join with Breast Cancer Campaign to become Breast Cancer Now. This organisation was later joined also by Breast Cancer Care. Delith led these mergers with an unusual perspective, having led both Breakthrough Breast Cancer and Breast Cancer Campaign at different points in her career. She talked to me a bit more about what she learned from the experience of leading that merger.
The main thing I've learned is the absolute centrality of having a really effective board, because if you don't have a really effective, high-performing board, then it's really hard to make the decisions that you need to make in order to get a really good process together so that you can come together. And ultimately, it's the trustees who have to step down in order to make the merger possible. So they have to decide to walk away from a charity that they're really passionate about. And so having a really good board that is very committed to the purpose and the strategy and making a difference for beneficiaries, that's a really, really important thing.
So that was Delith Morgan herself talking about the importance of a good board to guide through a merger process. And it sounds like she's had a fascinating career journey. Like you said, the focus has been predominantly on fighting breast cancer in a variety of different ways with multiple charitable organisations. And you said that she went from being chief exec of one breast cancer charity to becoming a working peer, and she's now a member of the House of Lords. How did that even come about?
So she left her role at Breakthrough to take up the job as a working peer in the House of Lords under Tony Blair. She told me that she's always had a very political upbringing. Her grandmother was involved in campaigning for the rights of women during the suffragette movement, and her mum was on the executive of the Welsh Labour Party. But despite that, she also told me she never considered herself a politician before. But when she got the call, she acclimatised pretty quickly. While she was there, she worked as a junior minister in two government departments, was the shadow education minister, and was also the Labour Party whip in the Lords. And she talked to me a bit more about what that experience was like entering the House of Lords as a relatively young woman.
I mean, it was an incredible experience because I was, you know, literally like a fish out of water, because it's a bit like, you know, a gentleman's club. I was the youngest. I think the average age was 68 when I went in. It's now a bit older, actually. And I was 43, had a school-aged child. It was really quite a culture shock. But the people, you know, I had a mentor. I had a lot of support from the other women in there. And then in time, when I was asked to become a minister, I'd kind of acclimatised. So I had a couple of years or so before I actually had to stand at the dispatch box and take questions and so on.
And then after a few years, she came back to the charity sector, giving up her position as a government minister. What did she have to say about the difference between working for charities versus government role?
So firstly, you can sense her enthusiasm for the voluntary sector just speaking to her about this. It's very clear that that was always her home, and she felt a very strong pull back to it when she left her job as a working peer.
Being in government and being a minister, it was an incredible experience, and I'm really grateful for that experience and a real privilege to be a minister in government. But equally, you can't beat the experience of running a charity, leading an organisation that has got a really clear purpose and where you're in touch with the beneficiaries, you going back into Breast Cancer Campaign. I just felt like, whoa, I'm at home. You know, this is how we do it. You know, let's get out there. Let's make Buckingham Palace pink, which we did. I mean, what an incredible privilege to be able to do what we all do, even when it's hard and resources are tough.
So as you said at the beginning, Delith Morgan is now retiring from the charity. What's next for her?
So she plans to keep a foot in that world. She still sits as a crossbencher in the House of Lords, and she had some really interesting things to say given that we are in an election year.
In the House of Lords, I'll be championing the causes that I can and, you know, wanting to support the sector. I think it's absolutely vital that any new government coming in has really, really respectful and thoughtful and strong relationship with the voluntary sector and thinks through how to have really effective partnerships between government, whether it's national government, local government, the NHS, how the NHS partners with charities like this. There is so much to be gained by working effectively with the charity sector. And it's not about doing stuff on the cheap. It's about working with communities.
And if you'd like to hear more from Delith Morgan, Emily's full interview is in written form on the Third Sector website. Moving on to our main discussion this week, we are delighted to be joined by Divya O'Connor. She was recently appointed Chief Executive of the Cherie Blair Foundation for Women, a post she came to from an interim Chief Executive role at the Girls Network. She's had a number of other charity senior leadership positions and started her career in the private sector. And it's great to be in the studio with a fellow podcaster because she is, of course, also the host of the very popular Charity CEO podcast. So hi, Divya. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Hi, Lucinda. Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be at the Third Sector podcasting studio.
Could we start by delving a little bit into your own personal career journey and specifically the multitude, it seems, looking at your LinkedIn, of chief executive positions that you've held. You've had a few years that you've spent in post and then two interim chief executive posts, as I said, most recently at the Girls Network, and then you also spent 6 months at the Chartered Institute of Fundraising. How does being in a role on an interim basis differ from a more permanent position?
That's a really good question. And I think actually my interim chief executive roles in some ways have been harder than permanent CEO roles because you come into an organization and you very quickly have to establish relationships, identify issues and problems, and engage with stakeholders. And you only have, as you said there, a short amount of time within which to essentially effect change or deliver a result. And I would say my interim CEO roles have really helped accelerate my own personal leadership skills and learning. On the positive side, as an interim, you do have a set mandate and therefore a defined scope in terms of what you need to deliver. And in some ways, it can be quite freeing to not be encumbered perhaps by the more political dynamics within an organization that certainly as a permanent chief executive, you have to be very mindful of and pay attention to. I think where I am personally right now, I'm very much looking forward to the work at the Cherie Blair Foundation for Women. What lights me up personally is really looking to develop and deliver longer term strategy and look at that longer term impact that an organization can have. So I'm very excited to be here.
And it must be, as you say, a very refreshing change to think, okay, so I'm in the seat now, I'm here for the long term view, and we're going to come to the Cherie Blair Foundation in a minute, but I think you were talking a minute there about the sort of key skills that you had to build as an interim coming in with these kind of short-term contracts, these fixed briefs. I would love to know, what do you need to be the kind of leader who can come in with a mandate to deliver a fixed change or something over a set period? What do you need in order to do that well?
I don't think it necessarily differs in terms of the leadership skills needed to be a chief executive, because whether it's in an interim context or in a permanent context, you are the one essentially in the hot seat and are the one who needs to manage things when things go wrong and also to lead. I think there are a few things in my experience that have stood me in good stead. Resilience, to be able to deal with whatever situation I find myself in. The ability to form effective relationships and to do so in a way that's personable, that's inclusive, and really harnesses the talents and skills of the people around you, that's within the team or the board or even wider in terms of colleagues in the sector. The third thing I would say is an absolute focus on culture, because this, in my experience, is so, so important. All leaders have to spend time in getting the culture right, because that really enables then everything that you're looking to achieve within an organization. And one of the things that very early on a guest on my podcast, the Charity CEO podcast, said to me that has really stuck is that the culture of an organization is formed not just by the positive behaviors that a CEO role models, but actually by the worst behaviors that they are prepared to tolerate. And that's something that's really stuck with me. So a real emphasis on culture, I think, is certainly needed in both an interim or permanent capacity.
And you've held a number of board positions, as well as obviously interacting very closely with the boards of the charities that you have led at the executive level. So you must have a pretty broad oversight view of different ways of charity boards working together, ways that it works, ways that it doesn't work so well. From that viewpoint, what do you think are the biggest pitfalls in charity management board relationships? How can people avoid those?
That's such a good question. And I know Deborah Alcock-Tyler will have a whole plethora of things to say in this space. Yes, I sit on the board of Book Aid International. I've been there over 3 years. Again, I will say it really comes down to understanding who you're working with, trying to understand that collectively, what are the skills and talents that we have in the room, and how can those skills, talents, and energies really be leveraged for the mission of the organization? And a real focus on the mission, I think, is critical. Oftentimes, there can be a little bit of a disconnect between what colleagues within an organization are doing or seeing, and perhaps what the board, who essentially a board are volunteers. They are a few steps removed. It is the executive who is in the organization day to day dealing with the problems. And the onus is therefore on the executive, and particularly as CEO, to be communicating that to the board so that the board members feel that they have confidence in the executive and that they have the information needed in order to fulfill their legal and fiduciary responsibilities. Because this is where I think sometimes lines can get blurred. The board has legal and fiduciary responsibility, and as part of that, they are also responsible for setting the strategic direction. Operational issues and delivery of the strategy is within the remit of the executive, and having really clear lines around delegation of authority is also, I find, helpful to make sure that that balance is achieved. And so both sides, both the board and the executive, are working together to drive forward the mission.
Absolutely. And as we know, Deborah Alcock-Tyler has, as you say, a wealth of experience in this area. We must get her back onto the microphone sometime very soon. I think something that comes up for me a lot of the time when talking about board executive relationships is clear communication as well. I hear a lot of the time that boards tend towards being more risk averse, shall we say? And there are obviously very clear reasons for why that is, especially when you are volunteers who hold, as you say, those legal and fiduciary responsibilities towards the organization. And again, it comes back to the idea of culture. So very important. And I think there are a lot of learnings kind of in terms of those relationships that probably also extend to partnerships between charities, in the sector as well, when you have two different organisations that are working together on common aims, in common cause areas, on common missions. So to come back to the Cherie Blair Foundation for Women, I understand that you are partnering with Care International UK around an advocacy programme. Could you tell us a little bit about that partnership relationship between your two organisations, and share with us any challenges or, you know, learnings that you have in this space?
Yes. If I could step back for a moment and give you a little bit more context in terms of the work of the Cherie Blair Foundation for Women, our mission is to empower women in low and middle income countries to start, sustain and grow successful businesses. And we do this in three main ways. One is through our direct programmatic work, through providing women with blended learning programs. We have a Herb Venture mobile app that provides bite-sized learning. And I know that the Her Venture was actually awarded the Third Sector Award for Digital Innovation a few years ago, as well as a mentoring program. We also do work in research, and that is very much in the space that I'll come on to talk to with the work with Care International UK, as well as working in the space of influencing and working with other ecosystem allies. And this is where I think that collaborative work is really important. According to the World Economic Forum's latest Global Gender Gap report, it is going to take 169 years for there to be equal economic opportunity between men and women and for that economic gender gap to close. And I'm very clear that the foundation isn't in a position to do something about that on our own, and that we have to work in partnership and collaboration with others in order to really move the needle on this. So the foundation has actually worked with Care International UK on a number of projects over the past 15 years since the foundation was set up. The most recent piece of work is looking at the realm of unpaid care work. Now, if you think about unpaid care work as an economy, it is valued at $10.8 trillion.
Wow.
And that equates to 9% of global GDP, or three times the size of the world's technology industry. So this is a ginormous problem. And what we know is that the burden of unpaid care work actually falls disproportionately on women and girls. And this is particularly acute in low and middle income countries. And gender stereotypes and social norms also play a big part in low and middle income countries, where care work, childcare, housework, etc., are very much seen as the women's domain. And so we are currently doing a research project with Care International UK and support of the Aries Charitable Foundation to really look into some of the levers here. And the advocacy project, for which we are going to be launching in a couple of months a joint policy briefing, is really looking to advocate the UK government, as well as governments across the world, to take action to address the issues that unpaid care work poses for women, and particularly for women entrepreneurs. The foundation has also done its own research in this area. So a couple of years ago, we surveyed over 700 women entrepreneurs, and 20% of whom told us that the burden of unpaid care work had a detrimental impact on their businesses in terms of limiting performance of their business or their potential to grow. And nearly 50% told us that actually the social and cultural norms played a big part, and their own friends and family told them to focus more on their family and children and less on their business. So there is certainly a long way to go if we want to reduce that time frame of 169 years to close the economic gender gap. And we are actively working with various partners in the wider women's economic empowerment sector to help achieve some parity there.
Yeah. And to come back to the partnerships themselves, what do you think are the core elements that make those so effective, particularly looking at Care International UK, given that you've actually had such a long-term partnership with that organisation?
There is certainly synergy of the mission and the focus on women and girls. We're both very women-centred in what we are seeking to achieve. And I think it's really important that within the wider ecosystem, that different partners, different actors work together to try and dismantle the barriers that hold women back and certainly that impact women entrepreneurs. The foundation specifically focuses on what we call the missing middle. So women who have micro, small and medium sized businesses, and they have a certain level of education and certainly digital literacy, because all of our programs are deployed via digital platforms. And I know CARE has a particular expertise in actually engaging with women entrepreneurs who are at the micro and nano level, particularly in rural and agricultural settings, and they have a lot of expertise. And one of our previous projects was in the context of village savings and loans. And so that complementarity is also important, where we are able to bring different areas of expertise together.
And you are also conducting research, or have recently published some research into artificial intelligence and the use of it and potential for more use of it, specifically generative AI by female entrepreneurs in countries all over the world. It's a discussion that we've been having recently on this podcast as well, thinking about how the charity sector as a whole should be responding to developments in this generative AI area and making sure that as a sector we're not getting left behind. I wondered if there were any findings from your research that could potentially be applied to where we are in the UK charity sector.
I think there absolutely are. We published research, a report called Bridging the Divide: Women, Technology and Business Success. And this was published with support from Intuit, where we surveyed over 1,100 women entrepreneurs across 80 countries, really trying to understand how do women use AI, what is their understanding of it, and also looking at the challenges in the digital sphere more broadly. And there were three really key findings that the research brought out. Number one is that women entrepreneurs are using generative AI in their businesses, but in order to really accelerate that growth, further support is required. 44% of the women we surveyed are already using tools like ChatGPT in their businesses, and 66% expressed an interest for wanting to actually learn more and have more training as to how to utilize these tools to their maximum impact. And they felt that actually a lack of knowledge was holding them back. The second really key finding is that access to technology and digital inclusion is a really key driver of business success. 92% of the women surveyed use smartphones for their businesses, and a large proportion accessed social platforms and e-commerce platforms in order to reach their customers and access markets. And the third finding, really soberingly, showed that online gender-based violence is actually highly prevalent in the digital economy. And 67% of the women entrepreneurs we surveyed said that they had personally experienced online harm. 14% said that they witnessed or experienced online gender-based violence on a daily basis. And 46% said that online GBV had a direct impact on their business. And so it is sad to see that some of the issues that we see in the offline world are really spilling into the online world. And in the online space, we don't necessarily have the protections and structures that are needed to prevent this. And I think this very much links, Lucinda, to the conversation on AI, because I listened to an episode that Third Sector put out a couple of weeks ago, where you had some experts talking about how charities are engaging with AI and using it. And I know we're all, including my own organization, in the really early nascent stage of this journey. But I think a really relevant point, particularly for charity leadership, is to think about what are the guardrails we need to have in place and guidelines that we can provide colleagues so that they are able to test and experiment using large language models like ChatGPT, but also understanding what's the sort of information that may be confidential to an organization. You know, how are we integrating data protection and privacy requirements so that information isn't going out there into the wider world? And I think we are very early in the journey as a sector on the thinking there.
Absolutely. And this is such a nuanced and such an important point. And we've seen this play out in multiple zones, something that you know, your comments have just made me think of is when Facebook launched, sorry, Meta, I should say, launched their so-called metaverse, you know, their 3D virtual world. And when they were testing the beta stages of that, female users were finding that when they went into this space, they were almost immediately being harassed. They were being targeted with inappropriate content. In some extreme cases, they were being sexually abused on this platform. And as you say, all of the discriminations, all of the biases, all of the structural sexism and racism that exists in the world around us today absolutely bleeds into digital spaces. One charity I think that's doing amazing work in this space is Glitch, and they campaign on two core issues, which is firstly that the online space, the digital space, is just as large a grounds for violence against women as the real world is. And they also make the very important point that, as in the real world, Black women and women from marginalized communities are the most vulnerable to abuse in this space. And their whole operation is around creating good digital citizens and safe digital spaces. So it's really interesting to hear how your findings are aligning with a lot of the platforms that they are campaigning on.
And in terms of the recommendations that the report makes, there are several calls to action here. Number one is we need to continue to design gender-specific, women-centered programs and products, and also design digital tools that enable the capture of gender disaggregated data, because that is what is going to allow us to really hone in on tackling the challenges of women and women entrepreneurs. And so that is absolutely key. Number two is the need to launch more targeted training on AI and on not just the benefits, but also some of the harms or the dangers with using AI and using these products. I think that is absolutely key, more awareness. And thirdly, there is a real need for everyone to call out and combat stereotypes, gender stereotypes, discrimination, gender-based violence, in particular online gender-based violence, wherever we see it. And that is something I think where the onus is on everybody in society, so that we can make these spaces, and particularly workspaces or places where women entrepreneurs access in order to do their business or do their daily work, so that women can feel safe and can go about their daily lives without the fear of harassment and abuse. And if you think about the younger generation of young girls coming through and their access to technology and digital spaces, I think it's even more acute and necessary and urgent that some of this is looked into.
And again, coming back to your, you know, recent appointment as the head of the Cherie Blair Foundation, again, it must be in a way almost motivating to know that you are now in post for a longer time, and to give you more space in a way to say, OK, we are now really going to take on these incredibly monumental challenges. And I have the space of potentially years. I'm not going to guess at how long you plan to be in post, but we've got a long time to really take an in-depth look at a challenge which, let's be realistic, is going to take years, possibly even decades to resolve.
Absolutely, Emily. I'm really excited to have joined the foundation at the end of last year, just as the foundation launched its new strategy. We have a really ambitious goal to reach 1 million women entrepreneurs by 2030, and I'm very much looking forward to leading the foundation in our work to achieve that goal.
Watch this space. Looking forward to it. Now, before we let you go, I think it would be remiss not to ask you about your podcast, the Charity CEO podcast, and your thoughts on podcasting for the voluntary sector more widely. What is it that you think makes your podcast successful? And why is podcasting well suited as a medium to the charity sector?
Well, as you both know, I am a huge fan of podcasting and of long form content. And congratulations, by the way. I know that the Third Sector podcast has reached 100,000 downloads, which is a great milestone.
Thank you very much.
For any show to reach. In terms of the charity context, I think podcasts are an absolutely fantastic medium to enable charities to have deep engagement with their communities, their supporters, to be able to generate new supporters and to really amplify your mission. And I'll give you an example of an organization that I think has actually used the podcasting medium in a really unique way. And that is Children England. And you will all know that recently Children England very sadly had to close its doors after 81 years. But before they closed, they took the time to record a series of legacy podcasts, which was really with the intention of preserving their work for posterity. And I have huge admiration for Kathy Evans, who's a friend. And Kathy and her team did some incredible work around creating and developing the framework for the Child Fair State. And that work has now been preserved in this series of podcasts and is available now as a resource for the future and for other organisations. And I think actually that's a really great way of using the podcasting medium. I think good podcasting is relational. It's really about creating that connection, about sharing and having meaningful conversations that really allow the listener to be drawn in and be able to connect with the content in a way and place and space that's actually meaningful to them. And certainly one of the things that's really important for my podcast, which is the Charity CEO podcast, is also having great production values and being able to really get to the heart of whatever the guests are bringing in terms of their particular expertise and what they have specifically to share. I think a key driver for podcasting success, in my experience, is consistency and the ability for shows to create and curate content and put out content that is of value to your audience on a consistent basis so that your show doesn't pod fade. And I know during the pandemic, there were many organizations and people who started podcasts and perhaps put out 1, 3, 5, or even 10 episodes and then disappeared or pod faded. And to any charity that is looking to start a podcast, I would say a few things. Number one, podcasting takes effort and time and resources. And you will both know that a lot of prep work and post-production work goes into producing a high quality 30-minute segment. And so for charities to really consider the resources that they have to put towards podcasting, to be really clear on the target audience, you know, who is your listener and what are the key stories and messages you are seeking to get across to them. And then again, as I said, planning so that you have a consistent approach, because I think if you were to pod fade, to use that sector phrase, that it could potentially cause more harm to your brand than if you were not to start a podcast in the first place. So I think it's a hugely exciting medium and one that has a lot of scopes. And I am certainly one who advocates for charities to start a podcast, but to also think carefully and plan that journey.
Absolutely. And I mean, the Third Sector podcast has been going now for more than 5 years, which is quite extraordinary. It actually predates me joining the brand. We, for the first year, were just putting out episodes once a month, getting to grips to that. It was only during the pandemic and after we'd been doing it for a year that we felt, okay, I think we have the capacity to take it up to a weekly format. And that was with the wonderful Rebecca Cooney, who steered it for the first few years. But now, you know, we have the amazing Lucinda, who, this is basically your job, is working on our multimedia, which is our podcast and our audio output. And it takes up huge amounts of time to schedule and meet guests and do all the post-production work with our brilliant studio team, Nav, and our other producers. And we're now experimenting, obviously, with new types of audio, but definitely don't run before you can walk, because it's better to build up slowly, I would say, than try and do something really big in the first instance.
Yes, it's really interesting you say that, Emily, because when I started the Charity CEO podcast, I initially was doing it fortnightly. And I recently, for the last 2 seasons, moved it to monthly. By moving it monthly, I was actually able to keep up the quality. So it had no impact on listenership and listener figures for me, and gave me the bandwidth to do it alongside my day job, as I still currently do. I have learned so much from conversations with various nonprofit leaders and from their wisdom and collective experience. I really enjoy it.
Divya O'Connor, it's been so great to hear your thoughts. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Emily, Lucinda. It's been a pleasure.
That's it for this week. Next week, we'll be joined by Mary Rose Gunn from The Four to talk about why there is a shortage of philanthropy directed at small charities and what can be done about it. Very much hope you will join us then. Thank you so much to our guest, Divya O'Connor, to our producer, Nav Pal, and to you for listening.